This is May 10th, 2009, Mother's Day. And thinking of Mother's Day, I found myself appreciating what it is about mothers that is so so precious in practice, Zen practice. And that got me to thinking of Dana. Dana, D-A-N-A, is the Sanskrit word for the first of the six paramitas, the six perfections. These six perfections are the ideals of a bodhisattva. That is, they are the qualities that we develop through practice and that can guide us in our practice, these six. And the first, which is giving, generosity, charity, sometimes is translated as, or dana, is it traditionally has been considered the most important of the six. I once gave a series of teshos on the paramitas, six of them, and came to really appreciate how the dana paramita, or just plain giving, underlies the other five as well. Because it goes right to the essence of practice. When we are really practicing to the fullest, that is, meaning we are most empty, we are giving. That is pure, the purest kind of giving. Or giving up. These two terms come together in practice. Our giving up is the highest giving. Giving up our clinging to our thoughts, our agenda, our opinions, our notions. But it all starts with letting go of the thoughts in the mind. Thoughts and fantasies and daydreams. And this also, we could say, is the highest form of relinquishment or renunciation. All renunciation really follows from this core renunciation of our thoughts, which really means giving up the self, because the self is just kind of an amalgam of thoughts, memories, associations, images. That's all the self is. When we let go of all that and just the pure absorption in our practice, whatever the practice is, every time we do this, we are developing our ability to give in every other way, to give up our personal preferences, our likes and our dislikes, to give up this self-concern, self-absorption, or what has been called the basic narcissism of human beings. So it's the most excellent kind of training in living up to the bodhisattva ideal, which is what practice comes down to, is just really doing this practice for the sake of others, to become vessels of giving, generosity. And that, to me, seems to be the real essence of the motherhood as an ideal, not just an ideal. I have always, well, at least since beginning practice, and and working through my mother, my issues of my mother, have always been in awe of what mothers give. Starting before we're even born, before the child is born, all of the strain, the discomfort, the pain of carrying children. Now, here's where I have to depart from speaking from direct experience, but I can still imagine a little bit what it's like. I can still appreciate it. We can all appreciate what our mothers did for us before we even emerged from the womb. The sacrifices then. They have this thing I've heard of. It's some kind of a device that the father-to-be, the husband, can wear. It's some kind of a weighted thing that they wear around their midsection, a sympathetic something or other. This hasn't seemed to really caught on too much. First heard about it about 10 or 20 years ago, and, you know, my initial reaction was, ew. But, yeah, you know, okay, give us men some sense of what, just a little bit of a sense of what that's like, doing that for 8 or 9 months. So it doesn't take a very reflective person to appreciate the mother goes through just in before we're even born, and then after birth, years and years of self-sacrifice, of giving. The sleepless nights. Cleaning above all kinds of body fluids. And, my parents said that we six kids were born in quick succession. We were all separated by a year and a half. And my parents said they went for 11 years without seeing a movie. There's this common childhood ailment that used to be called 6 weeks colic. My mother has told me that I had 6 weeks colic for 6 months. Every time she turned around, I was throwing up on something. Now, to be fair, there has to be some element of ego involvement in this, unless the mother is fully enlightened, a full Buddha, then there is always traces in everything we do. Any kind of giving, there are traces of pride or attachment. In the case of the mother, even more than the father, in the case of the mother, there is this. Fundamental bond that goes back to the symbiosis of you know, the child having carried the child, having the child and the mother having been one at one point. That's the real undeniable, irrefutable difference between the experience of the father and the mother. That child, any mother would say, that child was me and now has emerged into its own independent existence. Of course, we've seen in recent times how fathers are more and more assuming roles that were previously, just that of out of the mother. This I just saw recently was some statistic about how many men are staying home now and helping with the raising of the children. This seems to be a wonderful thing. And so some of these things that I'm saying about mothers could also be said about fathers who devote the same kind of time and attention and sacrifice to the children. But it's still largely a mother role, these kinds of things. And the qualities of motherhood are so intimately associated with qualities of devotion. The question would be to what extent a mother could bring forth that same devotion to a child that wasn't her own, that she knew wasn't her own. But even there, we certainly hear about those too. There's also a new phenomenon, or is becoming commented on recently, is the overparenting, so-called overparenting of children. And there was an article in the New Yorker last fall called "The Child Trap: The Rise of Overparenting," and I'd like to read some of this because I think it points to a real danger in overdoing this bond, taking it too far. It starts. This article is by Joan Acosella, and it's a review actually of several books on this phenomenon. It starts off, "We've all been there. That is, in the living room of friends who invited us to dinner without mentioning that this would include a full evening performance by their 4-year-old. He sings. He dances. He eats all the hors d'oeuvres. When you try to speak to his parents, he interrupts. Why should they talk to you about things he's not interested in, when you could all be discussing how his hamster died? His parents seem to agree. They ask him to share his feelings about that event. You yawn. Who cares? Dinner is finally served and the child is sent off to some unfortunate person in the kitchen. The house shakes with his screams. Dinner over, he returns, his sword point sharpened. His parents again ask him how he feels. It's 10 o'clock. Is he tired? No, he says. You, on the other hand, find yourself exhausted, and you make for the door, swearing never to have kids, or, if you already did, never to visit your grandchildren. You'll just send checks. This used to be known as spoiling. Now it's called overparenting, or helicopter parenting. I had to explain this to someone the other day. Helicopter because it's a hovering, parents who are always hovering over their children. Helicopter parenting, or hothouse parenting, or this is my favorite, death grip parenting. The term has changed because the pattern has changed. It still includes spoiling, no rules, many toys, but two other complicating factors have been added. One is anxiety. Will the child be permanently affected by the fate of the hamster? Did he touch the corpse and get a germ? The other new element, at odds, it seems, with such solicitude, is achievement pressure. The heck with a child's feelings. He has a nursery school interview tomorrow. Will he be accepted? If not, how will he ever get into a good college? Overparenting is the subject of a number of recent books, and they all deplore it in the strongest possible terms. I would just comment here that in both of these, the achievement pressure angle to overparenting also springs from the same anxiety. It's just two different forms of anxiety. It's at root, it's anxiety on the part of the parents, and which I think really goes to the root of all this, is the parents' own anxiety. It says more about the parent or parents than it does certainly about the child. And then this author who strung together the reviews of these five or six books, she mentions some examples. Most of us have heard of people who pipe Mozart into their child's room. And then she cites the first book, A Nation of Wimps, The High Cost of Invasive Parenting. The author, Marano, writes that you can now buy a baby, not just a baby Mozart CD, but also a baby Beethoven. Both are available on DVD as well, with the music supplemented by puppet shows and other imagery. These DVDs are for the 3 months and older age group. Since at 3 months, babies cannot sit up, parents will have to hold them in front of the monitor, and since these infants have only just learned to focus their eyes, it is hard to know what they will make of the material. Here's she quotes a Susan Lin, a psychologist at Harvard Medical School, telling the Chicago Tribune, "The baby video industry is a scam." And then there's the environmental hazards issue for parents who overparent. This author, Marano, says they see lethal bacilli on every surface. To thwart them in the supermarket, you can buy a buggy bag, a protective pad that you insert into the front of the grocery cart before you put the child in. According to buggy bags literature, this will guard against, quote, viruses, bacteria, and bodily fluids left on the cart. In a survey that Marano cites, a third of parents reported that they sent their offspring to school with antibacterial hand gels. Who trusts soap? And then she talks about the tutoring industry, spending big bucks to have your child tutored. And then she says, if tutoring doesn't do the trick, enterprising parents can argue with the school that their children, because of special needs, should not be held to a time limit in taking standardized tests. In 2005, according to Slate magazine, 7 to 9% of students in Washington, D.C. were given extra time on their SATs. Their scores, which were sent out to colleges with no notice of the dispensation, alongside the scores of students working against the clock, were, on average, well above those of others. When summer comes, the child is often sent to a special skills camp. Extracurricular activities and camps are areas where competition between parents, thought to be a major culprit in this whole business, is likely to surface. How do you explain to the other mother that while her child spent the summer examining mollusks at marine biology camp, yours was at a regular old camp, stringing beads and eating s'mores? Finally comes the last judgment. By the way, that competition among parents also, of course, grows out of anxiety. You know, how can I? It's social pressure. How can I say this to my peers, they're my other parents, that, you know, I'm not doing all this stuff, and that itself, that has its own anxiety. Finally comes the last judgment, capital L, capital J, college applications. Admissions officers, it is said, don't know what to make of application forms these days. Many of them have so clearly been filled out by someone other than the applicant. I'm skipping most of this material. I'm just dropping in some examples of what many people are concerned about now with how what parents, so many parents are doing. Well-intentioned parents, but this is where it gets so complicated, is that in our giving, our giving can be so contaminated by self-interest, and in the case of having with a child, the child is basically oneself. It's just an extension of the self. That's why I've heard parents say that it's so good to have more than one child, because the first one especially is just an extension of the parent's ego. To quote them as saying that. When the student goes off to college, over-parenting need not stop. Many mothers and fathers or their office assistants edit their children's term papers by email. They also give them cell phones equipped with GPS monitors in order to track their movements. In Marano's eyes, the cell phone, by allowing children to consult with their parents over any problem, any decision, any, quote, flicker of experience, has become the foremost technological adjunct of overparenting. Yeah, this is where I just have to tape up my mouth. Because I just cannot understand what it is that compels parents to check in with their child, their teenage child, every half hour when they're out, either by texting or calling by cell phone. These aren't children who are out carousing. These are children at home, safely at home, parents having to check in with them over and over and over again. What is that? And I have enough ability to self-monitor my, all right, I'll say it, dismay at this, to recognize that I don't know. Who knows? The jury's still out. We'll see what happens, you know, in the coming decades. There some measure of evaluation can happen as far as regarding these parenting, over-parenting methods, what we're now calling over-parenting. In Zen always comes down to speaking only out of direct experience. So what I'm doing, I'm assiduously trying to avoid judging these things because I don't know and I'm not a parent. But a lot of people who are parents are really concerned about the trend. Some parents, she adds, are not content with calling. They buy a second home in their child's college town. All right, and then she goes into stuff about that. And she then looks at the causes of, possible causes of overparenting. One is that the working mother, that seems paradoxical. If mother is at the office, how can she hover over the child? Well, she can hover at night and on weekends. The rest of the time, she can hire someone else to do it and secretly install a nanny cam. One model is disguised as a smoke detector. to make sure it's done right. Another cause is the insecurity bred of the global economy and global competition. A third one is the research on brain plasticity from the 1990s. The idea here is that while the infant brain is in part the product of genes, that endowment is just the clay. After birth, it is sculpted by the child's experience, the amount of stimulation he receives, above all, in the first 3 years of life. And that prompted many programs like this Baby Mozart and Baby Beethoven to try to get stimulate the infant. And then the author here, again, citing this other author, Morano thinks that the infant stimulation craze was a scandal. She accepts the idea of brain plasticity, but she believes that the sculpting goes on for many years past infancy and that its primary arena should be self-stimulation as the child ventures out into the world. While mother was driving the kid nuts with the 800th iteration of This Little Piggy, she should have been letting him play on his own. Morano assembles her own arsenal of neurological research, guaranteed to scare the pants off any hovering parent. As children explore their environment by themselves, making decisions, taking chances, coping with any attendant anxiety or frustration, their neurological equipment becomes increasingly sophisticated, Morano says. Dendrites sprout, synapses form. If, on the other hand, children are protected from such trial and error learning, their nervous systems, quote, literally shrink. Such atrophy, Morano claims, may be undetectable in the early years when overattentive parents are doing for the child what he should be doing on his own, but once he goes off to college, the damage becomes obvious. Morano sees an epidemic of psychological breakdown on college campuses. And then she's quoted here, the middle of the night may find a SWAT team of counselors calming down a dorm wing after having crisis managed an acute manic episode or yet another incident of self-mutilation. And then she goes on, or the author here, overparented students who avoid or survive college meltdowns are still impaired, Morano argues. Having been taught that the world is full of dangers, they are risk-averse and pessimistic. And then she's quoted here as saying, it may be that robbing children of a positive sense of the future is the worst form of violence that parents can do to them. You know, I think of this phenomenon of stranger danger, where kids are taught never to talk to a stranger. This is so sad, really. I understand the danger. We hear more and more how much danger there is, but boy, what a sad thing when you can't engage children as a stranger. You can't engage children in conversation without this sort of shadow passing over their face and their parents watching like hawks to see what might be happening. Many years ago, when I took more walks in the neighborhood here than I used to sometimes walk by the school just off Park Avenue up the street here, and would sometimes walk by when there was a school recess. All the kids were out. It's elementary school, and the kids were out doing what kids do at recess, and I just found it just so fascinating. I've always found it fascinating to watch children at play and how wonderfully spontaneous and fluid and what great models of Zen they are. But I became, as this Stranger Danger thing became better known, I became more self-conscious about just standing for those 10 minutes watching the children at play, because I didn't know whether a squad car would come tearing up and I'd have to start answering questions. So again, just to repeat, having been taught that the world is full of dangers, they are risk-averse and pessimistic. Schooled in obedience to authority, they will be poor custodians of democracy. Finally, and again, she stresses this, their robotic behavior will threaten American leadership in the global marketplace. That was the factor that frightened parents into hovering. And by their hovering, they prevented their children from developing the very traits, courage, nimbleness, outside-the-box thinking that are required by the new economic order. And then another book called Under Pressure, The New Movement Inspiring Us to Slow Down, Trust Our Instincts, and Enjoy Our Kids, by a guy by the name of Carl Honoré. And here I just marked a point here where she says that Honoré takes on domestic psychology, in particular the self-esteem movement, born of the 1970s. To him, as to other writers on overparenting, this is a matter of disgust. Every doodle ends up on the fridge door, he says. According to the research he's read, such ego pumping confers no benefit. A review of thousands of studies found that high self-esteem in children did not boost grades or career prospects or even resistance to adult alcoholism. If I am not mistaken, however, there is something about the self-esteem movement that strikes Honoré at a level deeper than the question of our children's competence. Morano is worried that we are producing a nation of wimps, people who won't make it. Okay, he's not the only one. Sooner or later, all critics of overparenting get to the problem of morals. This is, I think, really something that is not generally understood. The problem of morals, the sheer selfishness of these parents and of the children they produce. Morano asks, aren't parents manning the barricades, demanding benefits for all children? For all children. Why do they care only about their own? And doesn't it bother them that the extra help they can buy for their children, the college admissions courses, the tutoring, is tilting the playing field? Hovering, as most of these books acknowledge, is largely the preserve of upper middle class parents. And these people want their children to prosper as they did. Fairness be damned. So there's the other side of devoted mothers or fathers, is taking it too far, again, maybe out of the best of intentions, but the underlying concern here is that the parents not act out of their own needs rather than the child's needs. That's the question for parents, is when you're doing all of these extraordinary things for your children, how much of it do they really need, and how much of it is your own needs? The other extreme of overparenting is something I've read from in Sashin. It's a book called the autobiography of a great Chinese Zen master Han Shan. It's a long autobiography. But there's just one paragraph here that is pretty hard to forget. He had a mother who, Well, let me just read it. When I was 8 years old, I was boarded in the home of some relatives across the river so that I could be nearer my school. By the way, this, just to give you a rough date here, actually, there are no dates in this account, but it's a long, hundreds of years ago. It's just, that's good enough. I've lost my place. When I was 8 years old, I was boarded in the home of some relatives across the river so that I could be nearer my school. My mother forbade me to come home oftener than once a month. One day, however, I refused to return to school after my monthly holiday. When I told my mother that I could not bear to leave her, she became furious. She slapped me and chased me to the riverbank. But there I would not leave her to board the ferry boat. In a rage, my mother grabbed me by the hair, threw me into the river, and then turned homeward without once looking back. We're going to go for the middle way here in parenting. My grandmother, who was nearby, called for help, and I was saved. No, it gets better. Finally, when I reached home, my mother exclaimed, "What is the use of keeping this trash alive? It would be better if he had drowned." After this, she beat me and tried to chase me away. Then I decided, this is classic Chinese understatement, then I decided that my mother was too stern and cruel and that henceforth I would not go home anymore. But then, right after that, he goes on, "I learned later that my mother many times stood alone on the riverbank weeping. When my grandmother discovered this, she upbraided her." She criticized her. "With tears flowing down her cheeks, my mother answered, 'I must make him overcome his too affectionate nature so that he can study seriously.'" Well, it's very hard to judge this kind of thing. I mean, she sounds out of her mind, but then we have this other little account of her weeping. It's hard enough to judge parents of our own time and our own culture, much less someone in 11th century China. At the end, just to cut to the end here of this autobiography, he went home when he'd become this nationally famous Zen master, to visit his mother. He said he would visit her if she, just for 3 days, if she could keep herself composed. "When I reached home, my mother was overjoyed. She showed no sign of grief whatsoever. In her, I beheld only joy and good cheer." This surprised me very much. And then, cutting to the end here, "the next morning, I visited the graves of my ancestors to pay my respects. I also chose the site for the graves of my parents. At that time, my father was 80 years old. I joked with him, saying, 'Today I bury you, and so save you the trouble of returning to this earth again.' Saying this, I struck the ground with a pick. Immediately, my mother snatched it away from me and said, 'Let this old woman do the grave digging herself. I don't need anyone to bother for me.' Then she began digging up the ground in a lively fashion. I remained at home 3 days. When the time for departure came, my old mother was still in a very cheerful mood. Not until then did I become fully aware that I had a very unusual woman for a mother. I guess one of the great blessings of motherhood is being given the opportunity to practice selfless giving, or selfless as much as one is aware of it, selfless giving for years and years and years. Because of the narcissism of children, the parent, not just the mother or the father, parent gets very little back in the way of any kind of explicit thanks. Any parent knows this. The children, because the children sees the mother as just an extension of himself or herself, seems like the most natural thing to just receive from the mother and the father. And points to the highest kind of dana, giving, where there is no expectation of any thanks. This is what is really called the dana paramita. The perfection of giving. There's all kinds of giving. There's giving, material giving is one, the most obvious kind, giving things. And this is where parents can, again, overdo it, thinking that as long as they give enough things to their kids, that's going to make them happy, or, you know, make the child love them. There is the giving, this is from Buddhist texts, there's the second kind of giving, is the giving of fearlessness. I don't see how you're giving that if you're over-parenting or trying to keep the child protected for any kind of suggestion of a threat. There's the the third kind of giving is giving of education. And I think of here also of what a great act of dana it is for parents who do homeschooling. Teaching has been called the noblest profession. If you yoke the noblest profession to motherhood, you have a pretty strong resume. Used to be that it was the most natural thing for mothers to stay at home. That was what mothers did. It's what my mother did. And I think it's now important to acknowledge what a great, great gift mothering is. Full-time mothering. It's becoming less and less common, and for all kinds of reasons, but it has the potential of being just a great, noble calling to stay home with the children and devote oneself to them. And then as far as what can be given away, we always here that the highest form of giving is giving the Dharma. In Zen, that would mean being an example of the Dharma. So now, speaking of parents who practice, who do daily practice, you know, this has often occurred to me, if this is really the most, if I were a parent, this is what I would focus on is. This is what I hope I would remember, is that this is the most you can give a child, is everything that issues from daily practice, which means a calm, centered source of security to the child, a sense of balance where you're neither depriving the child nor overparenting, however one may understand that. So there's a sense of seeing the child as an individual in his own right, and not just a way to play out one's own insecurities and anxieties through the child. This is a fundamental problem in child raising, is the parent living his or her unrealized dreams through the child and putting all kinds of pressures on the child because of that. But I think this is the fundamental thing that a parent, a practicing parent, can give the child, is just to be an example of that. And that's where the teacher's role, I think, is the same with the student. In the end, it's not what I say in Teisho or say anytime. It's living what I'm teaching. Walking the walk. And this is what I would want to, this is what I deeply believe and want to try to convince any parent of, is if you're sitting every day and really learning through the sitting, learning how to give, learning how to let go of one's own self-absorption, one's own self-concerns, then the rest will more or less follow. I can't speak from experience as a parent, but doesn't this make sense that training the mind to let go and to respond, these are just the basic fruits of Zen practice, to develop responsiveness, to respond to the child, not out of one's own needs, but to out of the child's needs, and recognizing the child's needs means becoming attentive, developing attention, awareness, that this is the fundamental thing. And then the details are up to the parents, how this plays out. It'll be different for different children, of course, in different circumstances. Finally, it occurs to me that we all can become, we can bring forth this basic mothering quality to our own practice. What nurtures our practice? It's basically the same things that nurture a child. It's attention, bringing our attention to our practice, both in sitting and in action, in our daily activities. That's what it all comes down to. Where is our attention? If it's on ourself, this is not any kind way to bring forth the most in our practice, just as in parenting. We have to get our attention off ourself. Stop thinking about ourselves around the clock, and learn to turn it outward more, to at least bring some balance. You can overdo it either way, but bring more balance to that, and go from there. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.